This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Margot Price, is a country music singer and songwriter based in Nashville. She has a beautiful voice and is going to perform some of her music for us, including a new song she hasn't yet recorded. She has a new album called All American Made, which was described in Rolling Stone as one of the most political country records in years, a declarative honky-tonk manifesto of small-town farmer populism and working-class feminism. Her roots in the American Midwest are an essential part of her music, as you can hear on this track from her new album. The song, Heart of America, is about her parents losing the family farm when she was two.
Sometime back in 86, the big banks took the throne. They asked that every local farmer try to dry his own corn. But the men in suits had a bigger plan than to let it be our own. When the crops came in that spring, they were blown. And Neil and Willie tried so hard in battles they have gone. But that was still long after the much bigger war had been won. No one was there to save the wheat and the cattle at my home. They took every field my family owned. No one moves away with no money, they just do what they can. To live in the heart of America, get by on their own two hands. You can pray to anybody, Jesus, and be a hardworking man. At the end of the day, if the rain it don't rain, if the bank it don't break, we just do what we can.
That's Heart of America from Margot Price's new album, All American Made. Margot Price, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming to our show and for bringing your guitar with you. I really appreciate that. When you started singing and writing songs, why was it country music?
I always loved the stories, you know, being able to get out an entire plot in just 3 minutes. And I think it's just the way that I sang also, because I was drawn to so many different types of music. But there was something about my voice that just always, I don't know if it was nasally or that I was scooping to notes, but kind of no matter what I did, I felt like I couldn't get away from singing country music.
And you went to Nashville, where you still live.
Yes.
And your great uncle is a songwriter, and I don't know that I know any of his songs, but he's a songwriter who went to Nashville and kind of made his way there. Did that open up any doors for you, at least a door in your mind, thinking someone from my family did this, so maybe I can do it too?
Well, for sure. We would come down family vacation and stay with my Uncle Bob and my Aunt Helen for a couple days. And, you know, he had gold records hanging on his wall. He's written hundreds and hundreds of songs. He wrote for George Jones, a song called Writing on the Wall. You know, he wrote for Reba. He wrote for Charlie Pride and Tanya Tucker, and there's so many people. And he had a, you know, just a regular job, and he was living in Iowa. And his wife was supportive enough when he said, I want to go to Nashville. I want to be a songwriter, that they picked up everything and moved down here. And it did seem to be this impossible dream that he had conquered. But, you know, I do think that probably my mother thought that he could open all the right doors for me and there would be a nice, smooth transition. And I played him some songs like the first week I was here, and he sat there real quiet and didn't say anything. And I said, well, what do you think? And he gave me the best advice that he could. He said, you know, go home, throw away your TV, throw away your computer, just sit there and just keep writing. And it hurt my feelings, but I needed that tough love, you know, to tell myself I did need to keep working at playing and hearing other people's songs and seeing what made a good song. So I started going out to lots of open mics and listening to everybody and cutting my teeth.
I'm going to ask you to play a song from your new album. This is called All American Made. It's the title song. Would you introduce it for us and play a little bit of it?
Yeah. So, yeah, this song my husband and I co-wrote, and it's been around for a minute. You know, it's funny how songs kind of change their meaning as the world seems to change them for you.
How has the meaning of the song changed?
I think there's just more weight in it than at the time that I wrote it. And, you know, we wrote it during the Obama years. And I feel like I've always been one to question the people in charge. I enjoy playing the devil's advocate and being the protagonist. And so, you know, when I wrote the song, you know, I was still upset with things that were going on. But I think, you know, America's just in such a divided, heavy place right now. And I love my country so much. I don't want to leave. I just day to day wake up and read the news and feel confused. And so this song has helped on some gray mornings.
The song has a lot of verses. Do you want to choose a couple of your favorite and play them?
Yeah. Starting after the lead, about halfway through the song, is where my favorite ones start.
"1987, and I didn't know it then. Reagan was selling weapons to the leaders of Iran. But it won't be the first time, baby, and it won't be the end. They were all American made. But I was just a child, unaware of the effects. Raised on sports and Jesus and all the usual suspects. So tell me, Mr. Petty, what do you think will happen next? It's all American made.
That is Margo Price performing for us the title track of her new album, All American Made. Tom Petty slips in there. This was when he was still alive that you wrote the song. Why are you asking him a question?
Well, I think there's nothing more American than Tom Petty, and so when I started writing those later verses there, I thought he'd be the person who'd know what actually is All American Made. I'll just ask him. And then, of course, I thought maybe if I asked him a question, he would answer me, and then I would get to meet him. So I was really shocked when, because the album came out on his birthday, what would have been his birthday. That was just really a hard time, I think, for people on both sides of the battle right now. Everybody loves Tom Petty.
yeah. So in terms of, like, moving to Nashville to, like, launch your performing career there and try to get known as a performer and a songwriter. In one of your songs, you talk about, you know, starting to sing in the bars and running with the men. When you got to Nashville, was it like a real, like, guy scene that you became part of?
I think typically there's a lot of men out there doing it. That line was kind of a double meaning with, you know, it kind of meant, you know, just hanging out with the guys and the bars and the songwriters and whatever, but it was also just about infidelity and, you know, it was a weighted sentence.
Notice how I didn't even pick up on that because I'm that naive.
Okay. No, not at all. I don't think I've ever said that to anyone, so now the secret's out.
You also write not only about singing in the bars, but drinking a lot. And I was wondering, not in terms of the other meaning of running with the men or just hanging out with men, I was wondering if there was a period where you felt like you almost had to drink more, because I think sometimes women are supposed to show they can hold their liquor.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, when I first was let loose from, I had pretty pretty protective parents, and they liked to keep a short leash on me. So when I first moved to college, you know, there was a lot of binge drinking there. That was just what a lot of people were doing. And I was definitely known to be able to hold my liquor. You know, then I kind of stepped away from that and I started smoking grass, which just felt like I was more productive and happier. And then, you know, when I moved back to Nashville, a lot of people refer to Nashville as a drinking city with a music problem. And, you know, the bottle is talked about a lot in country music. And I moved here when I was 20 and I started working in a bar. So yeah, it's always been a slippery slope. And of course I medicated pretty heavily with booze after I lost my son.
This is not
the way to handle things. Yeah.
Your twin baby, you had two twin sons and one of them died at 2 weeks. And I just want to say, I know this is about 7 years ago or so, but I want to say how sorry I am. I imagine that kind of grief never leaves.
Yeah, it's been a tough one. You know, I feel much healthier now than when it first happened. And I've done a lot of personal work to try to move past it. But there's not a day that goes by that I wouldn't trade, you know, all my career and everything just to have him back. It's not easy.
As you mentioned, there are so many drinking songs in country music. Not like there's any shortage of them in rock, but but country, I mean, it's just like a whole genre unto itself, the drinking song. You have a great drinking song that I want you to sing for us. It's called Since You Put Me Down.
Yeah.
And you co-wrote this with your husband, Jeremy Ivey. Would you introduce the song for us and play a little bit of it?
Yeah, this song kind of talks about the duality and the good and the evil that we have inside of everybody. Since You Put Me Down.
Since you put me down, I've been drinking just to drown. I've been lying through the cracks of my teeth. I've been waltzing with my sin. He's an ugly, evil twin. A double crossing, backstabbing thief. I killed the angel on my shoulder with a fifth of Evan Williams when I found out you were never coming home. I killed the angel on my shoulder since you left me for another. I'm trying to turn this broken heart to stone.
That's a great song. And I really love your voice. What was the first music you sang? Was it country music? Did you sing in church? In school musicals?
I did a little bit of all of that. I grew up singing in church for sure. And I was in choir. So I did jazz choir and show choir and all those things. And my mom heard me singing one day. I was auditioning for like a variety type show that they put on in my school. And I think I was just singing a Christmas song or something. And she was washing dishes and heard my grandmother walked in and they were shocked that I could sing the way that I could. And after that, my mom really nourished my love of singing, and she would drive me an hour away to get voice lessons from the best voice teacher that was around. Her name was Sue Clark. And so I was singing mezzo-soprano Italian songs when I was even 11 or 12. And I still find myself, you know, trying to utilize that technique of breathing and phrasing and... but it's a little early for me to be singing right now. I think my voice always warms up after 8 p.m.
Sure, I know it's that way with a lot of singers, but you sound great today, even though...
I'm nocturnal.
We're recording this in the afternoon, but I think you sound great. One of the songs that you co-wrote with your husband that's on the new album, All American Made, is called Learning to Lose. And that's a duet with you and Willie Nelson. So you were lucky enough to have him sing with you on the album. So of all the songs you could have chosen to say, sing this one with me, why was it that song?
Well, when we were writing that song, we were listening to a lot of Willie Nelson records. And you know how it is when you get inspired by an artist and you kind of go through long phases of listening to them and really digging in deep. And so, yeah, that song we wrote in our bedroom. I had a cup of coffee. I was wearing my robe. We just barely woke up. And Jeremy grabbed the guitar, and it came out so quickly. And right when we finished it, we started thinking and saying to each other, wouldn't it be amazing if we could get Willie Nelson to sing on this song?
Why don't we hear that song with you and Willie Nelson? This is Learning to Lose, and it's from my guest Margo Price's new album, All American Made.
And they are the only devil I've ever seen was in the mirror. And the only enemy I know is in my mind. Won't you tell me how long must I pay all these dues? Won't you tell me when learning to lose. And you said it,
oh, but
say that it's not true. It's when it really
That's Margo Price and Willie Nelson duetting on a song she co-wrote with her husband, Jeremy Ivey. The song is called Learning to Lose, and it's from her new album, All American Made. Okay, so I had asked you before you came on the show if you would be willing to play a song that seemed very out of character for you, because I love to do that to musicians, to have them play something that we wouldn't think that they liked or that you wouldn't associate with them in some way. And you communicated through email offering to do a Kendrick Lamar song, which
I know
surprised
me. I don't
know
if I can do it. I know, I really don't. I could probably talk about it more than I could do it, but
No. You committed and now you have to do it.
No. I know, I've been trying to figure it out where I can make it work, and I just can't. I don't know if I can do it, but I mean, that's been the album that I have played more than anything this year. And I feel like I do want to figure that out, but I...
You want to do like just a few, just a tiny little portion?
Let me see if I can. Let me see if I can figure out. I've been trying to figure it out for the, you know, I sit around and play it and joke with my bandmates that we're going to do a full band version. But, bitch, sit down. Bitch. Be humble, bitch, sit down, be humble.
I have to say, it's hilarious.
It's really funny.
Like a heartfelt version of...
Yeah.
What do you like so much about Kendrick Lamar, considering his music is so different than yours?
DNA is one of my favorite songs off of his last album, and I've written about those same things where it's, people have such contradictory elements inside of them and like weakness, you know, I talk about that and Since You Put Me Down, where it's the devil and the angel on each shoulder, you know, you kind of are arguing with yourself. But I fell in love with To Pimp a Butterfly and just his overall outlook on things. And he's, you know, he's not afraid to speak out and speak the truth, and even when it's hard and people criticize him. I really admire him.
I was wondering if you'd like to maybe preview a new song for us that you have not yet recorded.
Yes, I would love to. This is a song that I wrote just pretty recently here, and it's kind of about a seeing the billboard on the side of the road that says 1-800-JESUS, and you want to call him because you've got to ask him questions, but you know, you don't know if he's actually going to answer, because sometimes it feels like you're talking to no one when when things are going wrong. So here it is, a hello operator, 1-800-JESUS.
Lock me up all by myself, throw away the key. I can't stand to read the news or turn on my TVs. Carnivores, religious wars, and they do it for the money. Rich folks eating four-course meals while welfare kids grow hungry. Hello, operator, could you get me on the phone? Like to speak with Jesus sometime if he's ever home. Heard that I call him up most any time I want, but every time I ring him, well, he never picks it up. So I went out to the diners, the dance halls and the bars, hanging out with the hippies, wondering where you are. Down every stretch of highway, I'm looking for my home. Call 1-800-JESUS from the billboard on the road.
I'll save the third verse as a surprise here for the future.
Okay. You'll probably record that at some point.
I think so.
Do you still go to church?
I haven't been to church in a while, but I enjoy going actually to sweat lodges and, you know, find different places to worship. Hiking and being out in nature seems to be where I feel closest to God, so that's where I go.
Margot Price, thank you so much, and thank you for being so generous and singing and playing for us. It was really just wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Margot Price's new album is called All American Made. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has looked back on a year's worth of reading and decided what books she thinks belong on the top of the pile. Here's Maureen's list of the best books of 2017.
For a chaotic year, I'm offering a chaotic best books list. But I think my list is chaotic in a good sense. These books zing off in all directions. They're fresh, unruly, and dismissive of the canned and contrived. Jessamyn Ward's gorgeous and bleak novel, Sing, Unburied Sing, takes readers on the great American road trip. But unlike Jack Kerouac's carefree roadster, Ward's junker is loaded down with a baby in a car seat, a couple of ghosts, a package of crystal meth, and the oppressive weight of racism, past and present. George Saunders' ingenious novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, is also a ghost story with origins in fact. When 11-year-old Willie Lincoln died of typhoid fever in 1862, his body was interred in a borrowed mausoleum in Georgetown. Newspapers reported that President Lincoln visited the crypt to open his son's coffin and hold his body. Saunders makes charged connections here between a president stranded in grief and a nation mired in the blood and gore of the Civil War. Three of my choices for top novels of this year are set in New York City. Alice McDermott's stunner, called The Ninth Hour, takes place in early 20th century Brooklyn, mostly in the basement laundry room of a Catholic convent. Out of this confined situation emerges a sweeping cautionary tale about the pitfalls of female self-sacrifice. Jennifer Egan's Manhattan Beach is an atmospheric and adventurous historical novel that centers on women's work at the Brooklyn Navy Yard during World War II. And Frances Spufford's Golden Hill brilliantly riffs on the 18th century novels of Henry Fielding and Lawrence Stern. It opens in 1746, when a man disembarks from a ship in Lower Manhattan and soon finds himself besieged by con artists in this city of dark alleys and twisted virtue. This year's best nonfiction is a grab bag of genres and tones. Richard Ford's small gem of a memoir about his parents is called Between Them. Ford's father was a traveling bleach salesman in the American South during the 1930s and early 40s. So a bonus with this little book is that it takes readers on an unsentimental but enchanted journey through that vanished landscape. David Grand's fascinating book, Killers of the Flower Moon, transports us to Oklahoma in the 1920s. Back then, members of the Osage Indian Nation had struck it rich when oil was discovered beneath the land they'd been exiled to by the U.S. government. But the wealthy Osage, whom the newspapers playfully dubbed Red Millionaires, attracted more malevolent notice, and a rash of murders via poison, arson, and bullets brought the newly formed FBI to the area. In What She Ate, Laura Shapiro follows the food trails of six prominent women like Eleanor Roosevelt and Eva Braun, and discovers fresher narratives lurking beneath their familiar life stories. Shapiro slyly likens her method of biographical research to standing in line at the supermarket and peering into the other carts. In the sizzling category of young adult fiction, Erica L. Sanchez's novel, I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, is a standout. Yulia is a 15-year-old Mexican-American girl living on the south side of Chicago. She's restless, angry, and uncomfortable in her own skin, always feeling secondary to her perfect older sister, Olga. But when Olga dies in an accident, Yulia becomes weighted down by obligation to her grieving parents. Smart and unpredictable, Sanchez's story delves into the vexed subject of female ambition. I could rattle off 10 recommendations for best books in the mystery category alone, but I'll end this list by bowing to a heavyweight of a hard-boiled collection that's just been published. It's called The Big Book of the Continental Op, and it gathers, for the first time ever, the 28 short stories, two novels, and one unfinished tale starring Dashiell Hammett's first series detective, known only as The Continental Op. The name Op derives from slang for a detective. Hammett's hero is an operative working for the Continental Detective Agency. In the early 1920s, Hammett revolutionized the figure of the detective and the language of detective fiction through the op, whom he referred to as a little man going forward day after day through mud and blood and death and deceit. I can't imagine a more pleasurable way to close out this chaotic year than by following the op through the fogs of a bygone San Francisco. But you can't go wrong with any of these books. As one of those dangerous dames the op falls for might have said, they're all the bee's knees.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find her list of the best books of 2017 on our website at freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Esther Perel, writes in her new book, The State of Affairs, there is one simple act of transgression that can rob a couple of their relationship, their happiness, their very identity, an affair. Yet this extremely common act is poorly understood. She adds, these are confounding times for couples. Eroticism is not always politically correct. Perel has spent the past 6 years of her long career as a psychotherapist focusing on couples who are dealing with infidelity.
She's heard a lot of stories, and those stories have connected with a huge audience. A TED Talk she gave in 2015 called Rethinking Infidelity has over 8 million views. An earlier talk from 2013 called The Secret to Desire in a Long-Term Relationship has over 11 million. She also hosts a podcast called Where Should We Begin that features real couples who volunteer to be recorded in intense therapy sessions. Esther Perel, welcome to Fresh Air. So, do you think we have unrealistic expectations of marriage?
We definitely have higher expectations of marriage today than we have ever had. Relationship expectations are at an all-time high. We want everything that we expected in traditional marriage in terms of companionship and economic support and family life and social status. And then we also want what the romantic marriage brought us, which was a sense of belonging and connection and intimacy and a best friend and a trusted confidant and a passionate lover. And then we now also want self-fulfillment and in our relationships, and we want to find a soulmate, a word that for most of history was reserved to God.
And somebody who stays sexy for us forever.
So, and the forever keeps on getting longer.
Well, in your book about affairs, you ask a question that I think people assume has an obvious answer, but maybe it doesn't. And the question is, what is an affair? Because it's kind of a blurry line. Like, as you say, like, is phone sex an affair? If one of the people sees a prostitute, is that an affair? Talk about that blurry line.
The definition of infidelity keeps on expanding, and there is no universally agreed upon definition of infidelity. It is often deeply culturally connected, and the lines keep on expanding. So if in the past you could say that the result of an infidelity was a child, and the child would come out 9 months later, and the color of the hair of that child would not resemble yours, and therefore you had a clear marker, things today are a lot more diffuse. And so when you ask, you know, is it a love affair? Is it watching porn? Is it only watching porn if the other person is live on the other side? Is it staying secretly active on your dating apps? When we say, is it, today the definition is often subjective and in the hands or in the mind of the two people that are part of one relationship. There is no hierarchical structure from above that tells you this is considered a transgression. And therefore, these conversations need to take place quite early on, in ways that they never had before. Monogamy can no longer just be assumed. It needs to be negotiated and defined.
Well, and you ask, like, is it still cheating when your spouse no longer knows your name because they have Alzheimer's and you had a patient who was in that situation?
Yes. This theme of my partner is ill, my partner is bedridden, my partner has MS, I am taking care of my partner, and this is a person who does recognize my name, but I take care of my partner, I am loyal, I am not faithful. I will be there till the last day to take care of my partner, who I love deeply, and in the last few years I have had a companion, a lover. This is a different state of affairs that is not titillating, that is not about narcissism, that is not about cheating, that is about longing and yearning and a desire for connection and for intimacy, all the while staying deeply involved in the relationship. So what it says is that the world of affairs is deeply complex, multi-layered, and can't so simply be reduced to black and white.
How often do you end up seeing couples because one of the members of the couple found the other person's phone or iPad, and they've seen texts or emails or photos that gives away the fact that they're having an affair?
It's never been easier to cheat, and it's never been more difficult to keep a secret. The majority of affairs would normally have died a natural death. Today, they are discovered primarily through the phone or through social media. or to the computer. So I would say that when people come to me or to a therapist in the immediate aftermath of the revelation of an affair, it is often because it's been discovered through the phone. Or somebody basically send you a message on Facebook or things like that. And then you don't just discover one message. That's the big shift here, is that you get to enter the digital archive and you scavenge it for hours and you see every hundreds and thousands of texts and pictures, and that is a death by a thousand cuts. That is a form of gutting that we didn't have before. You could imagine it. Now you're reading it, you're seeing it, and your entire reality gets shattered, and you can't leave it. So many people will come to see a therapist right after an affair is revealed or discovered or exposed.
So you say sometimes when we seek the gaze of another, it isn't our partner we're turning away from, but the person we've become. We're looking for another version of ourselves. Can you expand on that for us?
When you pick a partner, you pick a story. And that story becomes the life you live and the parts of you that become expressed. And sometimes you realize after years of living those parts of you that there are other parts of you that have virtually disappeared. The woman disappeared behind the mother. The man disappeared behind the caregiver. The central person disappeared behind the responsible person. And there is an expression of longing and yearning, longing for connection, for intensity, for a sense of aliveness, which is really the word that many people all over the world would tell me when they are having an affair. They don't talk about sex and excitement and titillation, actually. I'm talking affairs now. I'm not talking about just extramarital sex and the myriads of ways to do that. And what they say is they feel alive, as in vibrant, vital, as in a reclaiming of something that had gotten lost. A lost part of themselves, or a lost sense of youth, or a lost sense of possibility. And that often when there is affairs, people, those kinds of affairs, what people talk about is a reclaiming of the lost parts of themselves. And so they're not necessarily wanting to reject their partner. They don't want to reject their life. They love that partner and that life. What they want is to reconnect with a different part inside of them. And those are a certain kind of affairs. They're certainly not representative of the vast array of them, but they are very significant because they are often done by people who have been faithful for decades. These are not repeat offenders, philanderers, chronic strayers. Those are people that are very committed. They're not cheaters. They're a little more than that.
As a couples therapist, when you're dealing, say, with a couple or one partner wants fairly frequent sex and the other partner doesn't really enjoy sex and doesn't want it frequently, and they're therefore they've become sexually incompatible, what's your position for the partner who desires something that that partner can no longer get within the marriage?
I think that if you just ask a question about what to do with the discrepancy around desire for sex in a relationship, and you look at it just as if it's that what people miss is the act of sex, you sometimes fail to understand what it is that people are really asking for. You know, sexuality is often a pathway for connection, for intimacy, for tenderness, for sensuality, for playfulness, for power, for curiosity, for relaxation. And when people are deprived of sex, it's this whole set of feelings and experiences that they are deprived of, not just the act. They can have sex in various places. What they want is everything that the connection gives them. When they are deprived of that, what they often experience is a depletion of energy, of vibrancy, of aliveness, of vitality. That's what they're yearning for. When people complain about the listlessness or the lack of their sex life, they sometimes may want more, but what they want is better. And the better is the quality of renewal, of connection, of playfulness that sex affords them. So the first thing in the session is to make clear that this is the conversation is not about sex. The conversation is about loss. And it is loss on both sides. The person who is no longer interested sometimes is not so happy about that either. You know, and so it's, I wouldn't assume that it's just a comfortable, easygoing stance on that side. There are two people who are experiencing a sense of loss in their relationship, which they are both experiencing. It isn't one person is holding power over another only. Because unless there is rape in a relationship, it is the person who wants less who has the control, who has the power, that you can't force. And otherwise, you enter into a different dynamic. So
wait, I'm going to stop you. That's an unusual way of looking at it, that it's the person who wants less who has the power.
Unless there is coercion, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, if I don't want to coerce, I am at the mercy, I am dependent on your willingness. Maybe not even your interest, but your willingness. Yes, that is, I can go hike by myself if you are not there to want to hike with me. I can do a lot of things by myself that you may not be interested in. But this one is a shared experience. And if you do not want to share it with me, unless I impose it on you, you make the decision.
So in a situation like that, do you say to...
Man or woman, by the way, this is not a male prerogative.
Mm-hmm.
So, we should not fall in the stereotype of thinking that this is a man is interested and a woman is not. And this can happen in same-sex couples, too.
When someone no longer feels sexually aroused by their partner, is that something that you feel they can get back again, that feeling of arousal?
So arousal is one thing, desire is something else, and willingness is a third.
Okay.
We do not start sexually only because we are aroused and turned on. We sometimes start to be involved sexually because we have willingness. You're not always hungry, but then there is food in front of you and it smells really good and it looks beautiful and you taste and then you realize, after all, I wouldn't mind a little bit more. And then you eat, and then even after you ate, you may say, that was delicious, I wasn't really hungry. And you still enjoyed it. So we have multiple doors for entering into an intimate engagement with our partner. And excitement is just one of them. Sometimes you are desirous, but you don't have an arousal. You're not turned on physiologically yet. But you have the idea. You have the wish for it. You're in the mood. And sometimes you are excited and turned on, but you're not necessarily in a state of desire. I think we need to separate these... this concept and these entry points, first of all. Second of all, I think the more important question sometimes when it comes to desire isn't, I'll put it this way, a question I ask a lot is, I turn myself off how? I shut myself down. I shut down my desires how? And that's not the same as you turn me off when, and what turns me off is. That puts the responsibility only on the other person. As if, you know, if the other person did some amazing things, it would move me. The fact is that if I am shut down, if I've closed the door, you can do a lot of things. There will be nobody at the reception desk. There needs to be a receptivity, an openness, a willingness. And that is the fundamental sovereignty of desire. That is something that I own. I decide if I want to open that or not. So when you ask people, you know, I shut myself off or I turn myself down, you know, what they're talking about is the ways in which they have closed themselves off to the possibility of touch, of connection, of sensuality, of pleasure, of surrender, you know, for a host of reasons that range from sexual trauma to self-criticism to lack of self-worth to negative body image to issues of self-esteem. It is those things that make us close ourselves down.
Is that something you can help fix, though, to help create communication of intimacy and sexual fulfillment when it isn't there?
Yes, many times. That's the work. Yes. The work is about helping people often to reconnect with parts of themselves that they have neglected, or that they are in conflict with, or that they despise, or that they feel loathsome about. or that they don't feel deserving of, because they gain too much weight, because they don't feel like they've done enough, they have performed well enough at work, because their mother left them for another man, and so they decided that they would remain, they would be all mother, and they killed the woman inside of them the day they had a child, or because their father was violent and aggressive and they don't know how to bring together love and lust. Those are the deeper conflicts around desire and around intimacy and sexuality that I work with in my practice. This is a major part of the work. Not everybody, and not everybody with the partner that they are with, of course, but these are not irreversible, immutable stains. These are deeply conflicted experiences of life, and we work with that.
You sometimes tell couples where one of them is having an affair, like, your marriage is over. Do you want to start a new one? What do you mean when you ask, do you want to start a new marriage together?
It came from an idea that I had at some point, that most of the people in the West at this moment, or many people in the West at this moment, are going to have two or three marriages in their lifetime. And some of us are going to do it with the same person. Sometimes the crisis of an affair is the end of a marriage, the one that people knew for 10, 15, 25 years. And then the question is, do you want another one together? Do you want to create a different relationship with each other? Do you have enough between the two of you in terms of life, capital, history, shared values, love, care, attention, family, that says, I don't want to leave this. I still, you know, regardless of, you know, you hurt me badly and I still love you, or I hurt you badly and I still love you. And from that place, we're not going backwards. We're not going back to the marriage that you had. That's a given. And that means that the crisis of an affair often will light up the scorecard in a relationship, the compromises people made for the greater good, the arrangements, the roles they took on, the power structures that they accepted, the financial arrangements that they... Now, that's it. You can all renegotiate the entire thing. And it gives hope. It gives possibility. It says to people, this is a big crisis, but people can repair and repair. And people will develop resiliency out of this, and there will be post-traumatic stress, and there may be post-traumatic growth. Not for everybody. Many affairs will break a relationship. Sometimes it was already dying on the vine. And many affairs will remake a relationship.
Esther Perel, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Esther Perel is the author of the new book, The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. And that wraps up our final Fresh Air weekend of 2017. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a healthy and fulfilling 2018. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Saman, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.